On this episode of Big Boys Don't Cry, we discuss the film Sleepless in Seattle. You don't have to have seen the film to enjoy the podcast, but if you do proceed without having seen the film, just be aware that the plot will be spoiled for you. Enjoy.
Once, twice, three times, it's Paddy.
That's a good one. Did you stay up late thinking of that last night?
That was a spare of the moment thing, actually.
Well done. I'm impressed.
I was thinking of new songs to sing at you. I need to come up with a new one each week, I think.
Yep, definitely. That's definitely on you. I don't have to do anything at all.
I'm on it.
This is the price that you pay for me being the producer, is you have to come up with a different song every week.
I have to do everything creative.
Yeah.
Involving you have to do the actual Paddy. Creating of the podcast. I think I get off easy, let's be honest here.
Yeah. Although, you know, whenever I have to try and think of something like that, my mind just draws a blank, you know? Although Rob's quite easy. I suppose it's one syllable. Ooh. Hey, now, why don't you get a Rob?
All you need is Rob. Totally addicted to Rob. You give Rob a bad name.
Shake it, Rob.
Rob is all you need.
Because the player's going to play, and the shake it, Rob.
Shake it, Rob. Oh.
I like how that then changes that song from an instruction, well, a generic instruction, to an instruction aimed at a specific person.
I think that's how she meant it initially. And then they had to change it to Shake It Off.
Yeah. They were like, this song just lacks some universal appeal, but I can't work out what it is.
Why are you just singing it about someone called Rob, Taylor Swift?
Yeah, because you and Taylor go way back.
I mean, yeah, we're best buds. All the way back.
Yeah. Ever since you were both at the kindergarten in Crawley.
How are you?
Did you have a good birthday?
I did. It has been a very hectic time. So all we did was we went out for a curry.
Lovely.
And that was it for my birthday. And it was quite nice. Because I had a very busy day the day following, which is the day that we are recording. And I had a very busy few days prior to that. So it was, you know, it was nice to have a nice relaxing time.
Yeah. It's been an interesting time. We recorded a couple of songs last weekend.
We did,
which
yes.
I am working on production wise. They'll be done probably a couple of weeks because I'm about to go on holiday. We've got some stuff to do, but yeah, it was a good time. You came to see my house just before we started decorating, so now you'll be pleased to know that we've finished and all the strange wallpaper that the previous owners left is completely gone.
There we go. That is awesome. Yeah, you have a very lovely house, Paddy, I must say. Any listeners, if you've not seen Paddy's house, you're missing out because it's amazing.
Just come round.
Just have a look through the curtains.
All of you, yeah. Yeah, you can't come in, but you can look in through the window.
You can look in through the windows.
Yeah. So yeah, it's been nice to have a week off work to do that. Still feels like work, but different kind of work, I guess. I'm still tired at the end of the day, but in a different way. Nice not to have to commute.
Yeah, it is good.
I recommend it.
Everyone
even if
do
you
up
don't
your
have
house.
To, yeah. Even if you're not allowed to decorate where you live, just like decorate someone else's house. Yeah. Unless you are a painter or decorator, in which case I'd imagine it would be something of, as they call, a busman's holiday. Even though I've never heard the word busman in any other context.
No. If you are a painter and decorator, destroy someone's house. That's what you should do for your holiday. Turn up with a bucket of like horrible paint. Throw it all over the walls and walk out and be like, yeah, it's my holiday.
That sounds like a really bad kind of dystopian film or something like The Purge or whatever, where there's a week in every year where everyone has to do the exact opposite of what their profession is. So I have to spend a week of the year burning books.
Oh my God, Paddy. Paddy, 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 Paddy. We call it Opposite Day. It's a thriller. You have paramedics running around stabbing people. You've got booksellers destroying books.
You've got kings and queens being ruled by other people.
Yep.
UKIP being not racist.
Banks just burning money.
Yeah. Instead of you taking money out of the bank, you have to take all your money and like put it into a cash machine.
Yes, yeah, you have to shove it in.
Otherwise, you don't get any money the other 364 days of the year.
Football is playing rugby.
Mm. Baseball is playing American football.
Ice hockey players still playing ice hockey, but they have to push the stick around on the ice with pucks.
That would be excellent. That would sort of be like miniature curling.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, this is amazing. And then it's all about one person who's fighting against the system. He's like, we've got to get out of here.
Yeah, this is a barbaric tradition. Yeah, they're not going to save you this time.
We've got to reach the morticians before it's too late.
Oh, yeah. So they're the only people who can save lives.
Yes, exactly. That and mass murderers. They let serial killers out of prison just for one day, and they have to go around and save people from doctors. Because, of course, the prison guards would be doing the anti-job of letting all of the prisoners out.
Yeah, because the prisoners would be not imprisoned.
Exactly.
Dogs would be cats. It would extend to the animal kingdom as well. So all the birds would get in the sea and all the fish would get in the sky.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this writes itself, really, doesn't it? We're halfway there.
Yeah.
We're halfway towards a fantastic thriller.
We've Bon Jovi'd it.
We have Bon Jovi'd it. I think we could definitely get like Mark Wahlberg in to star.
Oh my god. This film was made for Mark Wahlberg.
He would totally be on board with this movie.
Yeah. Shia LaBeouf could be one of the crazy doctors.
Yeah, Shia LaBeouf is one of the crazy doctors. Mark Wahlberg is an ambulance driver who normally obeys the law of opposite day, but one day turns around and says, no, I'm not going to run over people in my ambulance.
He's mad as hell and he's not going to take it anymore.
He is not going to take it anymore. And he rebels against the system.
So we've got my main man, Shia LaBeouf. Who else could we have?
Tom Hanks, maybe, as the president, who is no longer the president on that day.
So he's he has to be kept safe. Otherwise, someone else could become president. There'll be some kind of presidential plot thing. Evil right-wing vice president trying to take over or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Played by, it would be Kevin Spacey if he hadn't been a bad man.
We could cast James Woods and just not tell James Woods it's a movie.
Yeah, or Clint Eastwood.
Clint Eastwood, there we go.
Tell him that Obama did it.
You won't believe this, Clint, but the last thing Obama did before he left office was declare opposite day a real day, and now you have to be the vice president of the United States.
Yep. It's an Obama nation.
Oh, dear.
Yep. This is going to be a very, very good film.
It's going to be incredible.
I think this has the potential to smash the box office even more than Sensations.
Yeah.
Because I think it has more universal appeal.
Yeah, it's not got that, because Sensations was purely sort of like a character-driven comedic romance film.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very thoughtful film, whereas this is just pure action. Obviously with heavy societal themes.
Sensations does not appeal to the bloke market,
no,
sadly.
No. But yeah, opposite day.
Yeah. Look out for that. Coming to a cinema near you in 2020.
Yeah. You'll see trailers for it before the next Purge movie, so watch out for that when you go and see the new Purge,
which will be called the Zero Purge.
Yes, because they've just done the first Purge.
Oh, purging back in time.
Can I tell you something, Paddy? I quite enjoy the Purge movies, I'm not gonna lie.
I haven't seen any of them, but conceptually I'm into it.
Yeah, it's quite a neat concept, and they're just quite good fun, I think, and they kind of point out, each movie as it goes on, it points out how corrupt the system is, in that it's very much focused on allowing rich people to maintain control, and for the people who are in power to maintain control. So the first one kind of hints at it behind the scenes, but then it becomes very, very apparent as the movies go on. And yeah, I quite like them. They're good fun. Good fun little movies.
I heard that the recent one, the first Purge, has upset some of the right-wingers with its anti-capitalist sentiment, so that's always good.
Yeah, I imagine it probably would do, but I'm surprised that they hadn't caught on to it yet from the series.
Well, you know, they're never the kind of people to willfully ignore something just because they like it.
No, I mean the first movie in the series, just to give you a general idea about the themes behind the Purge movies, the first film in the series is about a man who gets rich off selling security software and hardware for rich people to survive the Purge. It's about his house getting taken over by rich people who want to kill him on Purge night. And if that's not a kind of pretty obvious heavy metaphor to hit people over the head with, I don't know what is.
What's better, Purge night or prom night?
Oh, I don't know. What about ladies' night?
Oh, yes, it's ladies' night. Yeah, it's always better for it to be ladies' night. See, if we were talking about a teen movie this week, that would have been my segue, but I can't think of any way to segue this into Sleepless in Seattle, so... We might just have to.
If it was Purge night, you wouldn't be sleeping. So if you had a purge in Seattle, you would literally be sleepless in Seattle.
This is true. And there might be some kind of radio call-in show. You never know. Sleepless yes. in Seattle, calling into the radio, going, "Shit, I'm about to get purged.
What do I do?
Yeah. Whatever you're listening don't fall to, Purge asleep. FM.
Purge FM. So what did you think of Sleepless in Seattle?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I've seen this film quite a few times, actually. I realize it's a film that we revisit every so often, I think, when we're hopping through the films on the Netflix or whatever. And it's, it's a good one. It's Nora Ephron as well, right? We've talked before about some of her other work. But yeah, I like it. It's 1993, but it actually doesn't feel as old, I think, as some other films from that time. Even though there are obviously touches that date it, like the whole thing being based around a radio show. But it doesn't feel dated at all, in my opinion. But it was nice to watch it again. But you were seeing it for the first time. So what did you make of it?
I really enjoyed it. And as I was watching it, I thought the same thing, that, you know, this movie has not aged that badly. I'd say it's actually aged better than You've Got Mail, which is another Nora Ephron project with Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan. And I think, you know, obviously You've Got Mail has the issues of it being very much set in its time due to the sheer conceit of the story itself. Whereas here, you know, you still get radio shows. Yeah. These days it could be Tom Hanks calling into the Alex Jones podcast. and saying I'm sleepless in Seattle because the lizard people won't let me sleep.
That's amazing. And then they all take the brain force powders.
Yes, yeah, they're all on their brain force plus. And that's how they meet. They're both on the same mailing list for brain force, and they accidentally get sent each other's emails in a breach of GDPR.
Yeah. And then they have to resist the full force of the law as they try and find each other.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, I think like the general idea behind this movie hasn't aged that badly. So what you're left with beyond that, there's nothing that's jarring from a story perspective. So you're just able to focus on the characters and the development of the plot. And I think it does it very well, and it does it in a very interesting way, don't you think?
Absolutely. And I think it's a more interesting conceit than a lot of Nora Ephron's work, which is all good. Generally, she's a great writer, but I think this is one of her most interesting works because... the whole idea, it's not actually about two people falling in love as much as it is about two people finding each other when they need each other in a kind of extraneous and interesting situation. And it's about family and coincidence and fate and those kind of things thematically, rather than it's not a straight up, here's two people who are in love, but here's an impediment to that love. It's more about, here are two separate narratives and they... here's quite an interesting way of bringing them together around the kid's desire for his dad to find a partner and him to find a new mother. And that being done through this kind of radio show and letter correspondence. I really like the way that that all fits together. And it's a really, really great story in that sense. It really grabs you and it's really interesting.
Yeah, the way that I thought about this film was that this is a movie about the giddy idea of love. In that it's two people who have this idea of falling in love with someone, and they both almost love the idea of the other person, particularly with Meg Ryan. She doesn't really know anything about Tom Hanks's character, but she develops this almost infatuation with the sheer concept of this, the surprise and this giddiness caused by falling in love again. And I found that that was a really compelling way to tell the story. And there's very little in here, of course, that's anything to do with their actual relationship, because they don't really talk to one another at all throughout the film. And I just think it's a really clever way of conveying that feeling of that like early spark of love in a very interesting way.
Yeah, and it would be very, very easy to dismiss their love on that basis, to be that like, well, that they don't actually get together, that's not actually a thing, it's not, you know, that would never actually happen, blah blah blah, it's not about that. But the fact that it's kind of slightly unbelievable that they, when he takes her hand at the end, it's like, would he actually do that? But the film has set it up so well that you think absolutely he does that, and it's actually a really, really magical moment. So the setup really works with the payoff, which is no mean feat in narrative terms.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And yeah, you're right. When you think back on the sort of general idea of this story and those story beats, you do kind of think, oh, this feels very strange. But it works in context to the film as a whole, in a way that I don't think many other movies would be able to pull off. And I think the cynicism would creep in if it wasn't for how intelligent the script is, and how intelligent the way that they sort of call back to other ideas of romance as well. Because they do a lot of callbacks in this movie to old movies and things like that, that really helps bring home that this is a movie about love, but not in the sense of even the birth of a relationship, because at the end of the movie there is no relationship really. It's just hinted that, you know, everything's going to be okay and they're going to be together, but they don't even show like a first kiss or anything like that.
Yeah, you're left to imagine all that stuff. And you're right that it's about the idea of love rather than being a love story. And as a space to explore the idea of love, it does that really, really well. And often when romantic films deal with the idea of love, it's usually in the context of someone having an idea of love that is flawed or doesn't work, and it ends up ruining their relationship, or it's like they can't love someone in the right way because their idea of love doesn't work with the practicalities of that particular relationship. So it's usually that the idea of love is an impediment to the love rather than the thing that actually brings it all together. So to see someone on screen have that kind of romantic ideal and for it to eventually pay off is a really nice thing, and a really actually quite a unique thing in film, I'd say.
Yeah, it's and that's what I found watching it for the first time, is I had not really seen a movie that covered the idea of romance and the idea of love in this way before, which surprised me because I've seen a lot of films.
I don't want to brag, but I've seen a lot of films.
I don't want to brag, but you know, I've watched many films and I hold them all in a bookcase made of rich mahogany.
Yeah.
It's
I have many leather-bound DVDs.
it's a real unique movie in that regard. I've not really seen anything else that deals with the subject matter in the same way, which was very refreshing for me and not at all what I was expecting at all, really. I had no idea that it was going to be this interesting a film.
You just thought it was going to be Tom Hanks in Seattle, and he can't sleep, and Meg Ryan is like the sexy sleep doctor or something.
Well, I had a general idea about the film in that he calls into a radio show, and then they have the romance. But yeah, it's really interesting, and I love the fact that they weren't even in the same location and things like that. It was just a very neat film.
It is neat. The script is tight. The narrative is very, very tight. But at the same time, it still feels loose enough that there are some scenes where you feel like it's fun. And it's like background detail that you don't necessarily need, but it tells you a lot about the characters and stuff. Like, especially her scenes with Walter, played by Bill Pullman, who I kept thinking was Jeff Daniels because he looks kind of like him. But he was very good. And yeah, the scenes between them were just about bringing her character's idea of love to the table rather than being about him, but his performance really, really helped it as well. And there's little details that this that Nora Ephron is so good at. It's like the first time we see him, it's Christmas and they've gone to her family first to tell them that they're engaged, and it's all like it's all about how he's allergic to everything, and they're all like kind of making jokes about it but still trying to be respectful and dancing around it and that kind of thing. It's like, yeah, that idea of trying really, really hard to understand a person when actually it doesn't feel natural to you, I guess.
Yeah, it's I kind of love Walter in this movie, Bill Pullman, in that there's nothing wrong with him whatsoever, but there's just not that spark.
Yeah.
And you do kind of wonder, was there that spark in the first instance, or was this just kind of like a convenient two people like each other kind of situation going on? But it's yeah, and he is unbelievably sympathetic throughout the entire film. So much so that, you know, in the hands of someone with less quality as a writer, it could have been a real jarring point that there's this sympathetic other man in the story, that you kind of feel that there's a sour taste when he is left alone. But it works very well when she leaves him.
Yeah, that scene is amazing, actually, where they're having dinner on Valentine's Day across from the Empire State Building, where she has arranged to maybe meet up with sexy architect Tom Hanks at the top of the Empire State Building on Valentine's Day. And she's looking over at the Empire State Building thinking, is it going to happen, while she's having dinner with Walter. And she goes, I've got something to tell you. And you don't see so much of it, but then it goes back to the kid at the Empire State Building and then cuts back and she's told him everything. And he's really chill. And you're just like, wow, would he really be like that? But he would, because that's his kind of character. And because they both know that neither of them are conforming to this huge idea of love and romance. And that feels right. Whereas in a lot of other films, it would feel wrong or schmaltzy or tacky or whatever. But it's been set up in the right way to feel realistic.
Yeah, and you do kind of feel sad for him, because there's one line where Meg Ryan says something like, it's something along the lines of actually ever feeling that kind of spark where you know that you're meant to be with someone, and Walter says yeah, and it's like, oh, he has felt this with her, and she hasn't. That's not a good sign.
Yeah. Oh, I feel bad for him. Don't get me wrong. I feel like he deserves to find someone, and that it's a shame that he had to end up being in the background in that kind of way. But yeah, you also feel like, well, she feels the way she feels, and she has to follow her heart. That's as well. You feel like the film gives her space to follow her heart, and for you to feel like that's the right thing to do as well.
Yeah. And you know, it all works out quite well for Walter, because he goes on to be the president of the United States that fends off an alien attack.
Yep.
And then goes on to be a jazz saxophonist who bizarrely morphs into another character entirely.
And then he becomes a senator who saves the day in Opposite Day.
And then he becomes, yes, he assists Mark Wahlberg. And yeah, they, together they save the president.
He lends him a helicopter at just the right moment.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's interesting the way they deal with characters in this film. Nothing's quite as you would expect. And it's interesting that no one's really tried to ape this movie since, because this movie was made in 1993. It's been out a very long time. And it's interesting that nobody's tried to kind of do the same thing.
No, you could imagine them trying to remake it with like Justin Bieber and Selena Gomez or something like that. You know, it's been long enough now, 25 years or whatever, that yeah, they could definitely try and remake it, but it would be awful.
Yeah, I can't imagine anyone really handling this that well.
Yeah,
it's
and like, it's, sorry, just going back to Walter, I was gonna say something. Yep. So about how he is the collateral damage, if you like, but you still feel like it's okay, and you don't feel like she's an ass for dumping him. Whereas the films like two things ago, and in, well, actually in both the previous films, Chalet Girl and Four Weddings and a Funeral, the protagonist or the person the protagonist ends up with has to end a relationship on bad terms for the main relationship to happen, and it doesn't quite feel right. You feel very, very bad for the other person, and it kind of overwhelms the protagonist's getting what they want, and it just kind of leaves a sour taste. Whereas in this film, it was all tied up very, very neatly. So they should all take a leaf out of Nora Ephron's book.
Yeah, you're right. There's no bad taste in your mouth at the end of this movie when they do like get together. Whereas, yeah, sometimes it can be a real slog when they try and put in that that kind of difficulty caused by being in another relationship at the same time. You're like, well, why did he have to be such a dick about it? Whereas here, yeah, it all feels quite nice. It's quite amicable, everything.
Yeah, it is very amicable. That's the right word. There is tension and there is drama, but at no point does it ever feel like it's really kind of overly dramatic. There's Tom Hanks and his son Jonah have some shouty arguments at some point. But again, it's like you feel for both of them because they're both just trying to deal with the death of Tom Hanks's wife, his kid's mother, in their own way as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's the other thing about this film, is that it's not just about the romance, but it's also about overcoming grief and reaching that point where you're able to look beyond the pain of losing someone close to you and try and find something new.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very much about how we deal with death and bereavement and that kind of thing, and also how other people approach it as well. Like, Tom Hanks hasn't been dating for a while, and then I think a friend suggests to him that he go out with this woman, Victoria, who has the very, very loud laugh, and then he sort of, you get the feeling he's just going along with it because it feels like it's the right thing to do, and that's kind of his way of processing his wife's death. And that's a really interesting thing as well. And she's also kind of collateral damage, I suppose, but you don't really see her side of the story. But yeah, she's not great. But she's not a bad person either. That's the thing. It doesn't make her out to be any worse than she needs to be. She still seems kind of sympathetic. She just can't grab Jonah's attention, and she has a loud laugh and she's a bit dull. But her firm gets box seats to the Mariners, so...
So she's all right.
Yeah, but yeah, she's all right.
I wonder what happens to her in the end.
Yeah.
She runs off. She runs off with Walter. That's what I choose to believe happens.
Yeah, they could work. She'd just laugh at everything he says.
Exactly. He's a very funny man.
He is. Hilarious. He cracks very, very good jokes. Like, instead of a bottle of Dom Perignon, he says a bottle of Dom DeLuise.
Which is the height of comedy.
Hey, in 1993, Dom DeLuise was everywhere.
It's true. Yeah.
You couldn't move for him.
Can't argue with that.
He's in the library and at the bus stop. You know, everywhere you go, Dom DeLuise.
It is entirely accurate. You know, you open up your cupboard, he's there.
Yeah. He offers you a packet of crisps. Thanks, Dom. Yeah. But yeah, the waiter's incredibly straight face in the face of that joke is just fantastic. Hats off to the person who played that waiter.
The furious waiter who just can't wait to get away from the table and doesn't care if he ruins their evening.
Yeah.
Gotta love him.
And I feel as well like that Nora Ephron's romances and these kind of films, or films in the 90s like this, not necessarily written by Nora Ephron or directed by her, she actually directed this as well as having written the screenplay, but... I feel like these kind of films are also more for people around our age. So we've entered a new decade. We're both 30 now. And I feel like this kind of film, they're in their 30s. I'd imagine that they were around their 30s in this film. And isn't this film, Tom Hanks was 37, Meg Ryan was 33 or 34. And I think, yeah, it kind of shows that the romance is that little bit more mature. And it's refreshing because it doesn't seem to buy into today's culture of, you know, obsession with youth and beauty and all of these kind of things. And maybe I've just seen too much Love Island, but it felt refreshing from that point of view. I mean, I think Meg Ryan is beautiful in this film, and I think Tom Hanks isn't a bad looking chap, but it's like, it doesn't push that kind of agenda. Whereas if you look at all the kind of the 2000s, romantic comedies, everyone's hot and in their 20s.
Yeah, it is interesting that there's much more of a character focus and like an attractiveness based on emotional qualities in a lot of the sort of more dramatic romantic movies from this time period. And even like When Harry Met Sally, I don't think you're going to find
Billy Crystal. I'm sorry, but he looks like the underside of a boot.
he's not a heartthrob. They could have got, I don't know, 80s Charlie Sheen into that movie.
Yeah, or Emilio Estevez.
Yeah, someone who is like a genuinely mega attractive person. But instead they got someone who was able to convey a lot of character. And again, Tom Hanks in this movie can convey a lot of character. And that's what they're going off. And obviously, you know, Meg Ryan is very beautiful. But that's not what makes her character so interesting in this film. Instead, it's all to do with her character itself. And it's the same in You've Got Mail as well, and When Harry Met Sally. It's all to do with the character and the situation that the character's in and how the character reacts to them that helps build them, instead of it just being, let's chuck an attractive person in there.
Yeah. It's almost like that element of it never occurred to them as filmmakers, and that it was just before film and Hollywood really started to become obsessed with that, at least in the romantic comedy way. But you know, Hollywood's always been obsessed with beauty, obviously, but I don't know, something about it was just very refreshing. But on Billy Crystal, I have to say, as much as I was mean about his appearance, which I sort of half regret, sorry, Billy, I have a lot of time and respect for him because he's a huge baseball fan, and he made this film called 61, which is, like, it would probably be in my top 10 films of all time. It's so good, and it's a fictionalized account of the 1961 season for the New York Yankees when two players, Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle, were chasing Babe Ruth's home run record of 60 home runs. And it's just a brilliant drama, and his direction is just spot on. So I'm glad that he made that film.
Oh, brilliant.
Didn't get the recognition they deserved, I think.
See,
so
I've not seen
it. I've got time for Billy Crystal. Yeah.
See, I've got time for Billy Crystal because, you know, he's in The Princess Bride. Got to love The Princess Bride.
Yeah. That's an excellent film.
And he's also in City Slickers.
I've never seen that.
It's a comedy about a yuppie who goes to join a cattle ranch, and it's very silly.
I'm listening. Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, with old Billy in it. It's worth a watch.
I just look at his Wikipedia. It's When Harry Met Sally was 1989, and somehow in my head it's later than Sleepless in Seattle. I thought it was like mid 90s. I'm way off.
Yeah, no, it is an early one.
Yeah. I suppose he's just young enough to pull it off at that point, isn't he? By 1993, he's in full boot mode.
Prime boot.
Yeah. So that's a cool film as well.
It is, yeah. Yeah.
One for a future episode.
One in the future, definitely.
Yeah. So the kid in this film, his name is Ross Malinger. Born in 1984, so he would have been 9, which seems about right for the kid he was playing. I think he had the look about him of someone who grew up to be like really famous, but he didn't. I think maybe just in my mind he's kind of blending in with other actors or something, the way that recently, I don't know, I've been confusing scenes in films. Like I inserted the karaoke scene from Wills and Kate, the movie, into Chalet Girl. I think I'm just completely losing the plot.
you're slowly losing your mind in the heat.
Yeah. But he's like, it's like, you know, when you're on a website and you're trying to read a news article or something and you've already clicked through the 4 different cookie GDPR pop-ups or whatever. And you're like, now, please just let me read this article about how to make a nice guacamole or whatever it is. And then you get to the bottom or at the bottom and all along the right hand side of the page are all like those weird links where the content is pulled through from some kind of content farm rather than anyone deciding what to be. And it's like, yeah, we won't believe what these kid actors look like now. And that kind of thing. Like he's the kind of kid who would pop up on one of those weird links.
He was the voice of TJ. In Recess, though.
Ah, okay. That's cool.
Which is cool. Recess was an amazing kid show from when I was a wee laddie.
Recess was excellent. It never got the recognition it deserved.
No, no. And yes, yeah, so he was one of... I think there was multiple voices for TJ over the years, and he was one of them.
Right, because as soon as the kids' balls start to drop...
Then... they then have to swap to somebody else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the characters of Recess do not age. In the Recess universe, they are still the same age that they've always been.
Exactly, yeah. They can never age. So I think he started off as TJ, and then after like three or four series, he then was replaced by somebody else. But like that's a pretty cool thing to be. It's like, hey, I was TJ in Recess.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
And he was also in the incredible Jean-Claude Van Damme movie Sudden Death, which is all about terrorists that plant a bomb in the middle of an ice hockey game.
What?
And he's got to fight them off. It's great.
Is that not called The Puck That Couldn't Slow Down?
Holy puck, there's a bomb in the stadium.
I have not seen that, but it's now great. I would like to see that.
It's great.
Is
it's so good.
Is it NHL? Like, do they have actual hockey teams?
I don't know if it's got real hockey teams in it. Let's have a little look. It is. Yeah, it does. It's Pittsburgh Penguins versus the Chicago Blackhawks.
Ah, interesting. The Chicago team.
Yeah, so it's all set in Pittsburgh.
Well, something's got to be set in Pittsburgh.
There's a very good... sorry for diverting onto video games, everybody. This is just a risk you're going to have to be willing to take if you listen to this podcast.
I think if you listen to any episode before, you'll know that we talk about video games a fair bit.
Yes, we do. And yeah, in Fallout 3, there is a additional content pack called The Pit, and that's all set in Pittsburgh. And it's turned into like a steelworks / horrible hierarchical society with toxic mutants everywhere. And it's a very interesting little additional bit to the game. I think it was the best of the downloadable content for Fallout 3. So it wasn't part of the core game, but if you ever pick up the Game of the Year edition, you'll be playing that as well.
Cool. I'm just on Ross Malinger's IMDb page, and half of the photos of him are just pictures of the different language selections from the Sleepless in Seattle DVD menu.
Oh no.
There's no one vetting this content.
Ah, poor Ross Malinger.
Yeah. Oh, and someone's selecting subtitles off. That's a good picture. Yeah, DVD menus are always very, very bad. This has like really bad typography with like white over a white background. That's really hard to read. Like, why are DVD menus always so awful?
It's true. They are always really, really bad, actually.
I mean, it's not like anyone's watching DVDs anymore anyway, but it was the kind of thing where they never got good.
Yeah, they never improved. I remember when you used to get all of those random extras on DVDs. When they first brought out DVDs, and we didn't get DVDs for a while. We were still on VHS because it was too expensive. But then when you bought those early run of DVDs that they made, then they had all that random extra stuff on there that you had no intention of ever really using. Like sort of trivia games on the disc for the movie you've been watching and stuff like that.
Yep, trivia games, director's commentary... The trailer, of course, because, yeah, why not go back and watch the trailer after you've watched the film? Yeah, or deleted scenes, outtakes. Yeah, it's quite good. It was like, when DVDs first came out, it was like they had to justify the fact that they were giving it to you in this format and they could squeeze in all this extra stuff so that people would transition from VHS to DVD. And eventually, you know, but you buy a DVD these days, you might not even get a menu. You might just be straight in.
Straight in, just, you know, a big middle finger, and then the movie starts. But I can't. I sometimes love the director's commentaries, and sometimes they're very, very interesting. Like the any Arnold Schwarzenegger movie where he is giving the commentary, particularly if it's alongside the director, is among the best things you'll ever see in your life, because it's like watching it with a really enthusiastic friend. Where he's just like, oh, I love this bit where I pulled that guy's head off and stuff like that. It's brilliant.
Excellent. No, I can't say I've ever had the pleasure of watching a film with the Arnie commentary on, or if I've ever actually genuinely sat down and watched a film with the director's commentary. I think I should do that. I should do that with like a Richard Linklater film, just to make it even more kind of even more pretentious.
I wonder what his director's commentary is like, actually. I hope he's just joking all the way through, but I imagine it's going to be pretty po-faced.
Yeah, on Boyhood, where it's like, did you know, man, this took 12 years to make. That's like, it's just, he says that like at the beginning of every scene. Yeah, this scene, it's like 2 minutes in the movie, but it took us like 6 months to shoot. Add them all up, you get 12 years.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I think he's very, very good. We need to stop taking the piss out of him.
No, he's a good one. He's a good one. It's a light-hearted jab.
Yeah, that's all. For sure.
Made with love.
Yeah. And obviously, when we record the director's commentary for Opposite Day, we're going to do a fantastic job. We'll share lots of very, very interesting insights, cheer in all the right places, you know, tell you when to applaud.
Yeah, this is where Paddy got drunk and smashed up the police car.
Yep.
All that kind of stuff.
Yeah, we shot this scene in 38mm by mistake, but we didn't have a two camera setup like Tommy Wiseau, so we just had to go had to go with it. Yeah.
Oh dear.
I think it's going to be a great film.
It's going to be incredible.
It's all about the DVDs. We'll be able to just live off the DVD sales.
We will, because everybody buys DVDs.
Yep.
That's where the money's at. Yeah, so Sleepless in Seattle is very good, but there was some moments where I felt like it was a little bit slow.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It's not an overly long film. It's, let's see, running time 105 minutes. Like, I felt like it was certainly long enough though, and you could have cut a couple of the scenes and you wouldn't have noticed much. Like some of the scenes where Tom Hanks is hanging out with his buddies, or he's got like friends over in Seattle, and you're like, hey, he's just like managed to make friends with all these people. It kind of asks more questions than it answers. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, where it doesn't really add much to the overall sort of concept of it. And so you've got those scenes where he's with his sister, who's played by his wife in real life.
Oh yeah.
What's her name? Rita.
Rita Wilson.
Yeah. And she's really good. I like her a lot. In various things. And for instance, she is in an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. She is in Jingle All the Way, where she plays Arnie's wife. Before he goes off to become Turbo Man and show us all the true meaning of Christmas is to try and get a toy with all your might.
She's been with Tom Hanks since 1988. That's nice. It's not to be cynical, but often you go on the Wikipedia pages of these kind of couples and they're always eventually divorced.
Yes, yeah, you're right. It that often happens, which is quite sad.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. And it says she's produced some films as well. Produced My Big Fat Greek Wedding. There you go.
Oh, excellent stuff.
That's cool. And yeah, there's that guy who, what is his name? I'm looking at the thing. It's like he's actually British, but he plays one of the friends. Victor Garber. Yep, there he is.
Oh, old Titanic dude.
Yeah. And he's just in it as a friend for all of 5 minutes. And you're like, it's Mr. Andrews.
and then he's never mentioned again.
Yeah. I felt like they underused him. I feel like he had a lot to give to that film that he didn't get to give.
Yes, yeah. I feel like that as well. Is because also his character does make an impression in the brief amount of time that he's on screen as well.
Yeah. Also, he's Canadian. I had no idea.
Oh, I did not know that.
I assumed he was British. He looks British, doesn't he?
He does. He looks like a Brit.
He's got a sort of Downton Abbey look about him.
Yeah. For sure.
Or is he... Was he in Spooks, or does he just look a lot like a guy who was in Spooks?
I don't know. I don't remember him from Spooks.
I just watched really Spooks because other people were watching it, and it was kind of... I always thought it was boring, but kind of watched it anyway. It was one of those kind of shows. I'm not seeing it in his filmography there. I think he just looks like the guy from Spooks, whoever that is. But anyway,
see, he's Spooks had that very good early on. Spooks was very good because it did have that moment where it killed off a character who you were expecting to be one of the main parts of the show in a quite graphic and shocking manner. And I think it was only like three episodes in, and it's kind of like, oh my god. But then it stopped taking those risks and it just became kind of a spy show, which was a shame. But yeah, for that first series of it was very, very well done, and it really sort of hit home with a lot of people. But then it kind of just dragged on a bit, much like British television often does.
British television always drags, doesn't it? I can't think of any British TV show that doesn't drag. Don't at me.
I'd say The Thick of It was perfectly formed.
That's a fantastic show. You almost want more, actually.
Yeah, but you know that if you had more, it maybe wouldn't be as good. And where they stopped it, it's that perfect moment where you still want more of it, but you're not going to get it.
Exactly. It's the same with Nathan Barley as well. Actually, that's a show that doesn't drag because there's only six episodes.
Yes. It's either that they do so badly that they only get one season, or they drag them on for far too long.
Yeah.
There's very few British television shows that end at the best possible moment.
There's no in between.
No. Whereas with American television, you do have quite a lot that are ended too soon, but you do get some that are just like one series that then, you know, it feels right.
Yeah, or some, it's interesting, a lot of them seem to go on forever and have hundreds and hundreds of episodes, and then there are a few that kind of get a series and then fade into obscurity, but it is comparatively rare. But one such show is a show called Pitch, which is a film about a woman who ends up as the first female player in Major League Baseball, and it's fictionalized, but they use a real team, the Padres, and real players are in it a little bit, and it's really, really well done. And there's 10 episodes, and it's a fantastic drama show, really, really good. But I think it's just a little bit, the subject matter I think is seen as too niche, or they didn't market it well enough, or it was never shown in the UK or came to Netflix or anything. But it was written by Dan Fogelman, who's the guy behind This Is Us. Have you ever seen that?
That sounds familiar. Have I seen it?
It's got our main man, Milo Ventimiglia, who is off of Gilmore Girls, and he's brilliant in it. And it's a really, it's a show that at turns seems kind of cheap, but it really, really gets you. It's a very, very emotional kind of family drama that flits back and forth between the past. So you've got these three triplets, and it keeps going back to their early life, and he's the dad in like the 70s and the 80s. So it keeps jumping back and forth between all these narratives, but it's really, really, it's a really, really expertly done family drama, and it's just the right side of cheesy and cheap. But I think he's a really, really good writer, and he wrote this show before This Is Us, I think, or between series maybe. And he's good, and I think he's going to go a long way. I think it's had three series of maybe 10 to 12 episodes each. Well, that's an example of a good American drama that I think gets the pacing and the number of episodes right, whereas often there are just hundreds of episodes and it feels like a slog, you know?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I do recognise This Is Us now. I don't think I've watched it, but it has Sterling K. Brown in, who's one of my faves.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I'm all on board with watching it at some point.
Yeah, it's very, very good. Very well done. But yeah, that American TV, it's a funny one. But most British TV is bad.
Yeah, but it is a shame.
That's a truth universally acknowledged.
There's quite a lot of bad telly.
Yeah.
In Britain, don't let people tell you otherwise.
Have you ever seen the news?
Yeah, the news is rubbish.
News is shit.
And like, I don't know what they're playing at by having like concurrent seasons across multiple channels. It's not clever.
The content is very, very bad, and there's way too much of it. It's like you can never keep up, you know.
Yeah, they like basically do repeats multiple times a day.
Yeah,
and it's just like, why? I don't need this. I don't need to be bummed out by a TV show. It's
the same stuff, and they're like, they're recycling old content all the time. It's like, get some new material.
And like, you know, the one thing I will say about the news is that it tries to appeal to everybody, you know. There's something there for everyone. Like, if you're not interested in politics, you can go in there and see a little bit of sport action sometimes.
Yeah. But if you are all about the right-wing populism, as most of this country is, then it's got you sorted. hasn't it?
It has, yeah. It's you know, it's a weird show, the news. I'm not sure who writes it, but I think they could do better.
Yeah. They should take maybe
if they did it like twice a week instead of every day, they'd have more content.
Yeah. It'd be easier to fill that hour.
Yeah. Just a hint to people who make the news.
Yeah, the writers of the news. Yeah. Here are some tips for you. We got plenty more where that came from.
You want more dogs.
Yep.
Less politics. More explosions. Where you walk away from the camera looking cool.
Yep.
That's our tips.
And a few features on like what a busman is and other such historical British curiosities.
Yes. Take us through what different numbers of magpies mean in depth.
Yep.
That's what I want.
The old magpie rhyme. You know, if you see a solo magpie, you can salute it and then it won't bring you bad luck.
I have heard this from a grand total of 3 people.
Really?
But that is it. And everyone else I ask about it is just like, no.
Yeah. What are you saluting bird for, you idiot?
Why are you saluting that bird? Is he a general? Is he General Magpie?
Maybe he is a general. You don't know. We can't comprehend the structure of the magpie military, can we?
He earned his ranks in the Great War against the Crows.
Yeah. The Magpie Crow War.
It was a dark time for bird kind.
It was the best of times. It was the blurst of times.
Oh dear.
Yeah. So anyway, Sleepless in Seattle. Very good, very well put together. I like the way that it flows, you know, although you were saying it feels a little bit slow at times. I think there are just one or two scenes that are maybe a little bit baggy, or where she felt like it needed more characterization than it did because she was into writing the characters. And she got away with it, for sure.
Yeah, I think so. It's just a slight nitpick, the pacing a little bit off here and there. Because in general, it's really well paced. And a lot of the time you are glued to the screen and you're enjoying the enthusiasm of the characters. And like the playful nature of the way that it deals with themes and everything like that.
Yeah. And it is a romantic comedy, essentially, but it's not laugh out loud funny either, is it? It doesn't really try that hard to get the lols, does it?
No, there is no scene where Tom Hanks is dancing around in his underwear and then he turns around and someone else is there and he looks sheepish.
Yeah. Tom Hanks does not... He's not a small boy who then becomes a big boy and then it's all funny because he knows how to make toys. There's no such funny moments like that.
No, there is nothing like that in this film.
Yeah. Not out of 20, no big boy transformation.
No playing giant piano.
Yeah.
Not out of 20.
Whereas, I feel like in You've Got Mail and When Harry Met Sally as points of comparison, it tries just a little bit harder on the lols and tries to make light of situations a little bit more. But it doesn't really matter because this film actually requires, Sleeps in Seattle, I mean, requires a lot of investment in the characters and in the narrative for you to get the payoff when it gets to the point where they actually finally meet in the Empire State Building. So it is quite character heavy and character driven.
Yeah, for sure. And that really works in its favour, I think, is that it goes that little bit extra deeper than some of its peers and it really pays off.
Yeah, it does. It really, really works. It flows nicely, I think.
For sure, for sure.
What did you make of the jazzy soundtrack?
I quite enjoyed the jazzy soundtrack, actually.
Yeah.
It had that kind of playful quality to it, which is quite nice.
Yeah.
And it sounds very much of its time. A lot of the movies around this era that were the same kind of witty, not laugh out loud stuff going on kind of worked very well with these kind of soundtracks, and it's not something you really see anymore.
No, and it's really, really interesting because I think if you were to make a film now and put that kind of music with it, it could end up making it seem weirdly dated or like anachronistic, like it was out of time. But for some reason with this 90s film it works, even though it's like music that feels like it's from the 30s. It's really funny how it lends it that air of sort of slight sophistication almost, because I guess they were doing that a lot on TV in the 90s as well. It was a thing you were used to that says, here's like American Hollywood romance.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, again, it kind of puts it in this little time capsule for where it's from. But yeah, it works. It's nice. We like it.
Yeah, it's good. And there's all those like weird little animations as well. Like it had a really, really nice like ending title sequence as well with that could make someone happy song, and the little like the hearts appearing in the sky and stuff, which looks a bit like someone's media studies project, but it's still kind of cute.
You're right. It does kind of look like the first steps into doing like CGI.
Yeah,
it looks a little bit cheap, a little bit silly, but it's really good the way that it does it.
Yeah, it's nice, that quality, and it kind of, whenever there's a plane flying, they'll have the little animation of the plane flying over, which just like, it's almost a little bit silly, but it's charming. It charmed me.
Yes. Yeah. I liked it. It was a bit silly, but you know what? Sometimes you want things that are a little bit silly.
Yeah. It's good. Do you have anything else to add?
You know, I don't think I actually do.
I think we've covered it. It's a good film. Yeah. Very enjoyable. I highly recommend it. Whatever you like, whatever your persuasion, whatever kind of film you like. I think it's the kind of narrative that anyone can engage with, anyone can enjoy, you know. It's also, you know, got a good kid actor doing a relatively complex role, I think, for his age. And he pulls it off. It's good. It's about father and son. It's about death. It's about grief. It's about ideas of love. It's actually about a lot of things that sometimes films try to do too much to get all that across, but it manages to do it by tying Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan together with a thin but adequate thread that brings it all together nicely in the end. It's well done.
Yes, it is. It's a very smartly made movie that will make you feel good.
Yeah, and doesn't fade on repeat watch as sometimes these kind of films do.
Yeah, exactly. So I have a little bit of trivia, if you're ready for
it. I'm ready for it.
So the scene where Tom Hanks and our mate from the Titanic are sort of making fun of people crying over another movie, where they're pointing out,
oh yeah,
crying in the Dirty Dozen. That was actually improvised.
All right, that's cool.
Which is quite neat.
Oh yeah, because it keeps calling back to An Affair to Remember with our main man Cary Grant, which is a cool film. We'll talk about that at some point.
Yes, yeah.
And it's not like they're leaning on it too heavily, but that providing a bit of a through line and a bit of context as well for the swing music and all that kind of thing actually, yeah, makes that feel quite neat. And it allows her to get up to the Empire State Building at the end because the guy's wife likes it. And all that is kind of cheesy, but just about believable. I thought, yeah, that was a nice touch.
And that's the thing, there is that sort of neatness to it. It's all like, oh, yeah, everything ties together in a neat little package. So Meg Ryan ended up with the role of Annie and did an incredible job.
Mm-hmm.
But she was not actually the first person to be offered the role.
What?
In fact, Julia Roberts turned it down. Kim Basinger turned it down.
Wow.
Because she thought the premise was ridiculous.
I can see how you would think that if you read it just as a script, or if the story is told to you. If you can see that without seeing the characters come together on screen. I understand how you could think that.
Yeah. Then the other people who turned it down were Michelle Pfeiffer, Jennifer Jason Leigh, and Jodie Foster.
Wow.
And then it went to Meg Ryan after that. So they really went through a lot of people. I don't know if many people turned down the role that was offered to Tom Hanks, or whether he just got it. But Dennis Quaid was considered.
Ah, okay. Dennis Quaid. I'm going to look at... remind myself what he looks like. He's one of those people... oh, yeah, that guy. You know, I hear the name and I can never remember what he looks like. Yeah. Yeah, and then you got Randy Quaid, that's why. Yep, yep.
Yes, yeah.
But yeah, I think Dennis Quaid could have pulled it off.
He could have done it, but I think Tom Hanks has more charm to him.
Yeah.
which I think works in their favour. But Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan, they only share about 2 minutes of screen time together in this film.
Yeah, which is also very, very interesting when it's the love story about them. It's interesting.
Yes.
Oh, wait. Dennis Quaid was married to Meg Ryan from 1991 to 2001. So at this point, they would have been married. Ah, interesting.
I see. That's pretty cool. That would have been interesting, but a strange thing to rewatch.
Yeah.
So that'll do it for the trivia, I think.
Cool. Yeah, it's a good film. Well, Dennis Quaid also starred in the remake of Footloose.
Did he now?
Yeah.
I have not seen the remake of Footloose, I have to say.
That is a bad idea. Oh, Andie MacDowell's in it too. I wonder if she's as wooden as she is in Four Weddings and a Funeral.
I imagine not, because in general she's pretty darn good. I don't know what happened with Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Yeah, it was the lumpen script. Although, friend of the podcast, Adam Molesky, has said, he tweeted us about it to say, I enjoyed it more than you guys did as a trashy 90s Curtis verse film I'd never seen before. But maybe it was because it was a lovely, chilled 19 degree C Sunday afternoon. Fuck you! Where are you getting this 19 degree heat from? At 19 degrees? I can't even remember what 19 degrees feels like.
Yeah, today I was in a training session, a mental health awareness training day.
Oh, cool.
Because I'm increasing my responsibilities from mental health awareness perspective. There was people from all over the country there who had all traversed to London, and they were saying how ridiculously hot it was there, and how, you know, you had some people over from Northern Ireland, others from Edinburgh, all saying how much cooler it was up there. And I was just like, you know, you're complaining about the weather, but I'm so jealous. So jealous. I really want there to be a bit more cool.
I just want it to not be hot. We had like a couple of days where it was okay, and now today it's just been hot again.
Yeah, I'm unimpressed. Yeah. Not going to lie.
Sorry, I was distracted looking at the cast list of Footloose, the 2011 version. Nobody I've heard of, apart from Miles Teller and Andie MacDowell.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I can't say I've seen it. Is it just a bunch of young people?
It's just a bunch of young people, yeah. I don't think I've seen the original Footloose, actually.
I've seen the original. It's a very good little 80s flick.
Yeah. It's Kevin Bacon, right? You can't go wrong with Kevin Bacon.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
Kevin Bacon.
Did you know his real name is Eggson? But it was already taken in Equity. So he had to think of a new name.
Had to think of something else. You know Chumbawamba?
I've had the displeasure of knowing Chumbawamba, yes. I've even remixed one of their songs.
It was shared very, very recently. So one of their members, they are vegan, I think, as a band.
Is a Chumbawamba a sort of vegan sausage? Is that where the name comes from?
I don't. Where does the name Chumbawamba come from?
I'm gonna look it up. But yeah, anyway, go on.
I think it's the singer, the male singer. His name is Danbert No Bacon. No Bacon, all one word. And if I remember correctly, he used to go by the nickname Eggs. So it was Eggs No Bacon.
Eggs No Bacon. Wait, yeah. He's listed as a past member of Chumbawamba. Chumbawamba were a British band that formed in 1982 and ended in 2012. Oh, okay, they ended. Who knew? Also known as Skin Disease.
Also known as Skin Disease.
That's the worst name for a band ever. Yeah.
I'm searching, what does Chumbawamba mean?
Danbert No Bacon is, of course, not his real name. His real name is Nigel Hunter. former vocalist and occasional keyboard player in the Leeds-based anarchist band Chumbawamba. What's anarchist about Chumbawamba? I suppose the only song of theirs I know is Tub Thumping, so I'm getting the impression from their Wikipedia page that they did a lot of very, very different work.
Yeah, they were primarily sort of punk-based stuff, and also it wasn't all about their music that was anarchist, but actually about their protests.
Right.
One of them threw stuff at John Prescott and stuff like that.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
They were anarchist in their protests, if not in their music altogether.
Cool. Oh, yeah. This is actually very interesting. So, but then they ended up with this weird, huge hit with Tub Thumping.
Which, yeah, it's often the way, isn't it? Like, Stop the Cavalry was a protest song.
Yeah.
That then went on to become a Christmas song.
What a tune. I love that song.
It was not originally released at Christmas time.
Really?
No. but then, because they mentioned Christmas in it, eventually it became part of Christmas music.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, what else has Jonah Louie done?
You're going to tell me he was a member of Chumbawamba now, aren't you?
Maybe. It seems like they've had a lot of members. Oh, Jonah Louie, he's an interesting looking chap. He's got, in this picture of him relatively recently, he's got like the neck beard and nothing on the top.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, God, you're right.
He looks a bit like Alan Titchmarsh. He looks like a vegan Alan Titchmarsh. well, fair play to him, because Stop the Cavalry is one of the best Christmas songs, and I love it. Yeah, and so, some people in my household are not fans of the song, and we'll try and skip it if it comes on the Christmas playlist.
What's your least favourite Christmas song?
I don't know. As you know, I'm not a fan of Christmas Wrapping by The Waitresses, which is one of your faves.
Because you have no taste.
Because it's got that thing, that off, slightly off-kilter riff. That, yeah, not a fan of that. But yeah, Band-Aid can get in the bin, obviously, because all of the people behind it are wankers. Especially Bono, Bob Geldof, and all those people.
Excuse me, George Michael was a
part of
that.
Yeah, he's cool.
No bad word about George.
No, they're not all bad, but yeah. It's a very, very condescending song to the people of Africa and not very festive. Basically, if a Christmas song doesn't have a huge brass section doing an awesome riff that you can march to, I don't want to know.
See, for me, I hate the Pogues.
Oh, I know, yeah. We discussed
this. Despise that song.
In the PS I Love You episode.
I hate that song and I've always hated it.
Really?
Christmas Wrapping is the ultimate Christmas song, and anyone who says otherwise, including you, can get in the bin. Love that tune so much. It's one of those few Christmas songs that I would listen to all year round.
Well, why don't you then?
I do. Every so often I'll be like, oh, you know what I really feel like listening to? Christmas Wrapping. I'll just check it out.
I'm going to go and listen to The Fairy Tale of New York now, just to spite you.
You're supporting homophobia, Paddy. That's what you're doing by listening to that song.
Yeah, but it's Irish, so it's okay.
And here it comes.
I'm Catholic, okay?
How dare you? Yeah, that song can get in the bin. I don't know if that's my least favourite one. Isn't there that really, really miserable Christmas song by one of the ex-Beatles?
Wait, no, Paul McCartney's one is...
That's quite
Wonderful
upbeat.
Christmas Time. That one's
which is
great.
It's all expertly
parodied by Peter Serafinovich when it becomes "Let's all have a sexual Christmas time." Have you seen that?
Yes,
that is one of the greatest sketches ever. Now, are you thinking of "Happy Christmas, War is Over" by John Lennon?
Yeah,
that one. It's not miserable. It's good. It's an upbeat, strummy song.
It's a bit of a dirge, isn't it? I'm not a fan.
I hate Imagine. That is by John Lennon. That is genuinely one of my... That'd be in my like top five worst songs ever. Now, that is the definition of a dirge.
Isn't it one of the world's most loved songs?
Yeah, which is just further proof that that the world is bad. We've just let it completely
I don't like
go
Imagine.
To shit.
I don't really like John Lennon's solo material at all.
No. War is Over is I think probably the pinnacle, let's be honest.
I think the Beatle that came out of the Beatles the best was probably George Harrison in terms of solo stuff. Yeah. He was a cool dude who did some great stuff. Paul McCartney obviously did all sorts of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Live and Let Die is an absolute
Live
tune.
And die. Yeah, I've got a lot of time for Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
I'm worried that he might be getting old and Brexity, but who knows.
He also did that weird song with the surviving members of Nirvana a couple of years
ago. Oh, yeah.
In memory of Kurt Cobain, which is very strange. And then turned up in a aftershave/car commercial. You know how we can never really quite tell with those commercials? Yeah. I remember there's someone driving through the desert, but I think it might be for an aftershave.
Yeah. Was there a very, very chiseled man whispering?
Yeah.
And turning towards the camera in the rain
as well,
yeah.
Couldn't it? Yeah, they kind of blend together now, car adverts and aftershave adverts.
Well, they're either the really, like, car adverts are either really, really pretentious, like fragrance adverts, or like really, really low, like lowest common denominator, matey, like dog doing a shit on the pavement kind of humor. You know, do you know what I mean?
I know.
So
it's
like,
exactly.
Oh, it's so There's hard. No I've got to ground. Pick up the kids from swimming. Oh, no. It's going to be fine because I've got a car. You know, it's.
It's your car. Yeah. It's a car. That, it can drive.
That's literally every car advert.
But then there's also the this car will change your destiny, like some kind of magic curse. Yeah. And that's the other kind of car advert.
This car will literally turn you into a wizard.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You're right. There's no middle ground. It's either lowest common denominator or abstract art form.
Yeah,
nothing else in between.
And I hope that Paul McCartney's car advert, which I haven't seen, was of the lowest common denominator variety. It's just Paul McCartney driving to the chippy.
It'll be like that double glazing advert that gets put on every year. You know, you buy one, you get one free. I said, you buy one, you get one free. Just Paul McCartney doing that, but with cars, just pushing them over.
That is British culture in a nutshell.
I wonder if that guy voted for Brexit.
Definitely did. He thought he was going to buy one and get one free. He thought he was going to get a lot of free stuff from not being in the EU, but it doesn't actually work that way, sadly.
They said if we Brexited, we'd get one free.
Yeah, it's going to be a Brexit bonanza.
Brexnanza.
Yeah. But let's not talk about that fucking shit.
No, done with that. Done with that nonsense.
Yeah. So rate to Sleepless in Seattle. What's your score? How do we score it?
That's a tough one. How many hours would you listen to a radio call-in with Tom Hanks?
Yeah, with Dr. Marsha Fieldstone, who yes. is not real but could easily have been real.
Yeah.
I would listen for, I'm going to say, 16 hours. I think it's a good
nice.
Film. It's a very, very good film. It doesn't quite reach the lofty heights of the, you know, 17 range, but it's definitely up there. It's definitely very, very good. And there's lots to like about it. It's very, very interesting. And I think, actually, it's a little bit underrated, actually. People don't tend to think of it as much, but I think it's some of Nora Ephron's best work and of Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan's best work as well. It's good. It's interesting.
Yes, I agree. I'm going to go for a 15, pretty much for the same reasons. It's a very interesting movie. It's very well put together. It's a very likable film and you really root for the characters. It's not perfect, but it does something that very few movies do, if any other movies do, in the way that it sort of builds itself as a story. So yeah, it's good. I like it. Go watch it.
Yeah. So yeah, just mark down a couple of points for a little bit of slowness and a little bit of bagginess. But overall, yeah, very, very good.
Yeah, I approve. Gets my approval.
Good. So your choice next. What have you got?
So yeah, I have three choices for
Ooh,
you.
Oh, okay.
So you can decide. One of them, I'm not entirely sure whether it fits on this podcast, but it does fit with our recent discussions about movies, so I'm going to include it. So you have a choice of a weepy, a dramatic thinky or a potential shit piece.
So weepy, thinky or shit piece.
Yeah, that's your choice.
The name of my three children.
It's like Tots TV. It's the new name of the little tots in Tots TV.
Yeah, or like the new Teletubbies.
I'm a tot, just wheeze and tot. weepy, thinky, shit piece.
Well, I am too much of a troll person to not go with a shit piece. So it's gotta be.
Gotta be shit piece.
What do we got?
Okay. So we are going to be watching the sci-fi romantic creeper movie Passengers.
Okay, cool. I don't think I've even heard of it.
It stars two very good people. It's Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt.
Oh,
but I've never seen
dog,
it.
I have
heard
of
that
this.
There is some. I've never seen it myself, but I've heard that there are some serious problems with the general plot of the film, which I'm looking forward to discussing with
Excellent.
You.
Excellent. Okay, I'm looking at this now. It's got Michael Sheen and Lawrence Fishburne in supporting roles. Okay. Our main vampire, Michael Sheen. Wow.
Our main non-vampire, Lawrence Fishburne.
Michael Fishburne.
Michael Fishburne.
Okay, I don't want to give too much away, but okay, wow, I'm excited about this. This looks insane.
I have heard that there's one central flaw with this film that ruins the entire thing, and I'm looking forward to finding out your thoughts about
Excellent.
It.
Excellent. You haven't seen it, or have you?
I have not seen it myself, no.
Cool.
No.
All right. Well done.
And I'll keep the other two on the back burner, and I might offer you the same choice, but out of two films next time around, unless I get inspiration elsewhere.
Yeah, and I should try and do the same thing. Give you, because realistically, every film that we talk about can fall into one of those three categories, right?
Well, I think we often talk about comedies, and there was no comedy to be found in my choices this time around.
Yeah, that's
true. A little bit of comedy in the weepy, but primarily a weepy.
So you got a weepy, a thinky, a shit piece, or a lol fest.
Yeah, and those are our options of general. You know, when they were talking about the there's only a certain number of kinds of storytelling available to human beings, that's actually what they were talking about.
The four basic plots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I particularly like shit piece, I'd say.
Yeah.
As a basic
If plot. I was teaching a creative writing course, the seminar on shit pieces would go on for a long time.
I mean, you'd have a lot to dissect.
Yeah,
you?
Yeah. There'd be lots of coursework on The Room and stuff. Yeah.
Right, excellent stuff. Do you have any other business?
No, I just want to say, would you call The Bridges of Madison County a shit piece?
No, I wouldn't call it a shit piece. I think shit piece is where there's a catastrophic failure down the line. I'd put that into the weepy.
Yeah, yeah. It's got some terrific weeping in it, and it
does.
Can potentially make one weep as well, so.
Yeah.
It's been one weep.
Shit piece is a very shit piece is a very special category. Yeah,
it is.
It transcends general plot. It's more of a structural failure of a film.
Yeah. What about, is Jupiter Ascending a shit piece? Like a good shit piece?
Oh, yeah, I'd kind of put that into a shit piece movie category. But it is a good shit piece.
Yeah, so you can have a good shit piece or a bad shit piece.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be a bad movie.
Yeah. Interesting. I'm liking this as a categorization. I think we should focus on this in the future.
Listeners, what do you think of our categorizations? What's your favorite shit piece movie?
Yes. Please tell us. You can get us to us on the Twitters at BigBoysDon'tPod or on the emails BigBoysDon'tCryPodcast@gmail.com. Always love to hear from you. We will read your correspondence out and tell you you're wrong.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, sorry guys. Unless it fits with our categories, it is incorrect.
Yep. But thanks a lot for tuning in. I really appreciate it. I hope you enjoyed watching Sleepless in Seattle, and we will be back next week to talk about Passengers.
Yes, indeedy. Bye-bye.
Bye.